Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us on our Thursday edition of Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in this morning for Tom Williams. Those of you familiar with Utah State University's schedule over many years know that an important event occurs each fall. On campus, the Leonard J. Arrington Mormon History Lecture, which now takes place at the Logan LDS Temple. And that, in fact, is happening tonight. We're pleased, as we have in past years, to have the guest who's being brought in to give that, one of the nation's more prominent Mormon scholars, a professor of comparative literature, of English and religion literature at Richmond University. Our guest has a PhD in comparative literature at UNC Chapel Hill. Terrell Givens will be presenting tonight at 7 p.m. The title is The Prophecy of Enoch as Restoration Blueprint. And the program is free and open to the public. They also have a writing competition for students. There's information on campus. And 7 p.m. downtown Logan at the Logan LDS Tabernacle. And Terrell Givens, thank you very much for coming in to join us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I don't want to have you obviously give your entire presentation. That would make no sense because that's coming up tonight. But I'm interested in a little preview. I'm interested in talking about some of your other books. You have a new collection that's coming out in a week, The God Who Weeps. But you have a lot of books over the course of the years. You were originally published by Oxford. And I'm interested also in how it is like to be a scholar in your field right now at what's been called the Mormon moment, when we have Mitt Romney running for president, when so many things have coincided, the Broadway show, many other things happening, and you get called on. You've appeared in the PBS series The Mormons and CNN and other forums. What it's like when you have a career in scholarly research and publishing, and now there's also this popular culture version of Mormonism that people are looking at.
Well, I think that being a Mormon scholar at this particular time in history, which some people are calling the Mormon moment, is a little bit, in Charles Dickens' words, it's the best of times and the worst of times. Whereas it's the best of times because none of us would have anticipated 10 years ago that Mormonism was going to be in the spotlight to this extent or for this prolonged a period. And so it's somewhat exciting to have suddenly a large audience interested in your field, in the work that you're doing, and to be called upon to share your research and insights. It's a little frustrating because we don't have as much of a role as we would like to in shaping the conversation. We mostly are responding and reacting to developments rather than guiding those developments in the focus of the questions.
Has any of those questions surprised you?
No, I don't think they've surprised me. They've disappointed me, I guess I could say. The a typical example of the kind of frustrations I think that some of us feel was an interview that I did just last week with a prominent national newspaper who wanted to talk about some of the more esoteric aspects of Mormon belief. You know, I get asked frequently about Kolob or Mormon underwear, and on this occasion it was the backstory to Adam Ondi Ammon. And then as a follow-up, the interviewer wanted to know why people tended to be more interested in the peripheral doctrines than the core doctrines. And, of course, the answer is because people like you keep asking about the peripheries. And so that can be a little frustrating, not just because we would rather talk about things of more essence, but because to a public whose knowledge and exposure to Mormonism are somewhat limited, it doesn't help matters much when the periphery becomes the center in the public conversation. That creates distortions and misperceptions, which I think many of us would like to see corrected.
And there has been speculation on how this would enter as a factor in the presidential race, and I'd say so far, not much.
No, I don't think so. Apparently, as many polls tell us, the number of people who would not vote for a Mormon candidate appears not to have changed much in recent decades. So the centrality of Mormonism as a topic of conversation seems not to have altered the dynamics one way or the other in that regard.
Our guest, Terrell Givens, is giving the Leonard J. Arrington Mormon History Lecture tonight at 7. And our conversation this morning is live. We'd invite your questions. You may be familiar with some of his books or other work and have your own question. Feel free to join us toll-free at 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email to our website at upraccess@gmail.com. And by the way, how did you end up in this field? I know you did study at BYU. And
I did, but Mormon studies was the furthest thing from my mind and initial training. I trained really as a scholar of Romanticism with coursework in intellectual history at Cornell as a graduate student. Began my career at the University of Richmond in 1988 teaching British and European Romanticism. The way I fell into it was almost entirely a coincidence. My father was an avid book collector, and one of his special interests was anti-Mormon literature.
Oh.
And so he had developed quite a collection of curious and odd, mostly 19th century texts. And he knew that I was a literature professor, so he kept pushing these to me, saying, you ought to do something with this. There's some really interesting stuff going on in these books. And I wasn't inherently interested in Mormon history per se, but as I began to peruse these series of articles in Harper's Magazine and novels by everybody from Sherlock Holmes to Mark Twain, it occurred to me that there were some really interesting patterns that were manifest in these representations of Mormonism that generally had to do with orientalizing of Mormonism, also the prevalence in these depictions of coercion, either mental coercion or physical coercion. And it turned out that there was actually a book to be written out of these materials. So my first book was a kind of crossover book that addressed the intersection of religion and literature. So I talked about how representations of Mormonism in 19th century literature affected both, actually public policy, politics, legislation, and perceptions of Mormonism that persist to the present day.
Which title was that?
That was The Viper on the Hearth.
Right.
Mormon's Myths and the Construction of Heresy. And they're actually just reissuing that in a new edition in just a few months.
Oxford University Press.
Correct.
And that's a pretty good place to land for a scholarly publisher.
Well, I never imagined that I would place my first book with Oxford. They turned out, I remember one of the conversations that I had with the senior editor of religion at Oxford. I said, well, I'm delighted but somewhat surprised because I see that you already have a book on Mormonism in your line. And she laughed and said, well, Mormonism is the American religion. I think there's room for more than one or two titles. So they've turned out to be an absolutely tremendous publisher to work with.
How many books have you published with Oxford?
I don't
have to count. Five or six?
Five or six. I've got three or four more pending publication or in the pipeline.
And also interesting, I read somewhere, I've been trying to gather some background for this interview, that Richmond University is a Baptist institution founded by Baptists.
Yes, it is. There's really a kind of delicious irony in the fact that I teach at a university founded by the Baptists in the year 1830, while I'm writing principally on issues that have to do with the intersection of literature and Mormonism. They actually severed the last of their formal connections to the Baptists just a few years ago, so it's a pretty thoroughly secular university now.
Has that irony been noted by others, your colleagues at the institution?
It doesn't seem to have to have been noted, but I will say that I have been delighted by the level of support that I have found there among faculty and administration alike for my work.
Well, we have you here primarily because we want to share with our listeners, obviously, your work, but also promote some interest in tonight's presentation. And I'm wondering how you landed on this title, The Prophecy of Enoch as Restoration Blueprint.
Well, I think my interest and passion for the Book of Enoch comes largely through my wife, Fiona, who's an absolutely marvelous reader of texts and extremely perceptive and sensitive critic and scholar in her own right. And she's long emphasized the fact, to me, at least in private, that the Book of Enoch makes one of the most remarkable contributions in all of Mormon thought to our understanding of God as a vulnerable God. God is a passable deity. And the more I delved into the Book of Enoch, the more I realized that a close examination of Enoch could provide the basis for what I thought was a fairly substantial reevaluation of the way in which early Mormonism developed. And what I mean by that is one of the traditional narratives that Mormon scholars have told, and many still tell about Mormonism, is that Joseph Smith, as a prophet and thinker, was a man who went through various stages of theological reasoning, that he begins with a kind of 1830s vision, then he progresses to what some call a Kirtland theology, and then by the end of his life he's teaching this radical King Follett Nauvoo theology. And yet it strikes me that in the Book of Enoch we actually find, rather explicitly in most cases, the kernels of virtually everything substantial that he had to say by way of theological development. In other words, we find there the key to the passable God, which one needs to remember is actually quite remarkable in 1830s when all of the creeds are still insisting on a God without body parts or passions. Smith is insisting, no, God is the most passionate and empathic and feeling of all beings. We find also in this 1830 text an allusion to human preexistence that is quite clear and explicit.
And the topic of your most recent book, I believe.
That's correct. That's right. And much recent work in the Joseph Smith Papers Project has actually indicated the extent to which the language that appears in the Book of Enoch and in poetic renditions of the prophecy of Enoch, also from the 1830s, were really decisive in influencing the early development and celebration of the doctrine of preexistence. So Enoch has a pivotal role in that theological trajectory. And then, of course, one finds as well that we have what I think continues to be the most important doctrinal statement on theosis, or the belief that men can become like God, presented in the Book of Enoch, where it's not only proposed as an idea or as a possibility, but we actually see Enoch enact in miniature this process of divinization. And it's quite unlike the more popular and traditional Mormon narratives of how they envision that process to unfold.
You write that this book exerted more of an influence on early Mormonism than many other things, like the Book of Mormon.
Right, and that might sound like a surprising statement. What I mean by that is the Book of Mormon is certainly more important in terms of what it represented. And I've long argued that the Book of Mormon was far more important in early Mormon history as a sign rather than as a carrier of meaning. In other words, it wasn't what the Book of Mormon said. It was that the Book of Mormon existed that was the important point. Virtually no significant Mormon doctrine is uniquely presented in the Book of Mormon. If you were to ask a Mormon to name 5 or 10 distinctive aspects of their faith, it's likely that none of them would come from the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon doesn't talk about preexistence. It doesn't talk about the 3 degrees of glory. It doesn't talk about the Word of Wisdom. It doesn't talk about church hierarchy and Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthoods. So you don't really get the foundations of Mormon theology in the Book of Mormon, but you do get those foundations, as I'm arguing tonight, from the Book of Enoch.
Our guest, Harold Givens, is giving the Leonard J. Arrington Mormon History Lecture tonight at 7 in Logan at the LDS Tabernacle. It is sponsored by a variety of university-affiliated organizations, including special collections and archives at the Merrill Kazare Library, the Leonard J. Arrington Lecture and Archives Foundation, College of Humanities and Social Sciences, and Utah State University, free and open to the public. And he's with us live this morning. If you have a question, comment, or a thought to share, you can call us at 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email at upraxis@gmail.com. And I don't know, perhaps for our very general lay audience and someone who's been away from the area for a while, about the Book of Enoch, where it came from.
Well, Joseph Smith finished translating the Book of Mormon in March, and it comes out in published form in April of 1830. Or actually, it comes out at the end of March. And the remarkable thing to me about Joseph Smith's early career is that immediately upon completing and producing the Book of Mormon, rather than glorying in this accomplishment, publishing or preaching from it, or developing the ideas or doctrines from this kind of magnum opus, he immediately turns to other projects. One of the first of which is to retranslate the Bible. Of course, it's not really a retranslation; it's more of a kind of commentary and redaction. And he doesn't even get through the Book of Genesis before he's producing these additional revelations that seem to come out of virtually nowhere. And one of them is recorded in what has come to be called by the Mormons Moses chapters 6 and 7, later canonized as part of the Pearl of Great Price, which comprises what Joseph Smith referred to as the prophecy of Enoch. And Enoch, of course, is an Old Testament figure, patriarch, who appears in Genesis. There are only a few verses dedicated to the person Enoch. And yet what we have in the prophecy of Enoch is a whole life that is fleshed out, a whole ministry, a marvelous ascension narrative in which he effectively ascends to heaven and converses with God himself. He sees God weeping and asks, "How is it that thou canst weep?" We find that in subsequent decades, a number of other Enoch texts come to light, and there's quite a voluminous literature today on Enoch as an apocryphal figure and variants of the Enoch story. Joseph Smith's appears to be one of the very first, and as I said, quite remarkable because there isn't any kind of textual history or antecedent to it that we can trace. He claims, of course, that it's produced by his prophetic powers, prophetic vocation. But what we do have is a fairly remarkable text.
And if that hadn't been brought forward, the direction may have been very different?
Well, it's hard to say because, as I said, we don't find many of the most distinctive Mormon teachings in the Book of Mormon itself. I think that Mormons have been rather reticent about talking about what to me are the most interesting and fundamental aspects of the Mormon faith, which aren't gold plates and angels and the Book of Mormon, but a particular narrative that Mormons tell, that Joseph Smith told, about the nature and meaning of human existence, which begins in an infinite eternal past. He proposes, right, that the human spirit is uncreated, that it's eternal, and which culminates in a version of deification, that men can actually acquire the status of the gods. And you find all of that in the Book of Enoch, but you certainly don't find that in the Book of Mormon. So it's hard to imagine how Mormon theology would have developed the way in which it did without that seminal text.
We're going to hang on a little bit longer. We have a short break to take, but we're going to continue this discussion. I'm interested in your most recently published book, one that's coming out in a week. And again, this general area of religious studies, USU acquired its own program a few years ago with approval of the state. I'm wondering if you have a general view on the evolution of religious studies in the United States.
Well, if you mean Mormon studies more in particular.
Yeah, from that perspective.
Yes. The question is still an open question as to what is the validity or the future of Mormon studies as an independent sub-discipline or sub-field. And I think the jury is still out. You have, as you indicated here at Utah State, a professor of Mormon studies in Phil Barlow, who by all accounts and evidence is doing an absolutely tremendous job. That's within the framework of a religious studies program. Elsewhere, at places like Claremont in California, you have an actual Mormon studies program. And the University of Virginia has recently made public its quest to secure the final funds to endow a chair in Mormon studies at that university. So it would appear that the Mormon moment that is more than just an epiphenomenon, but it may actually leave a lasting imprint insofar as we see the emergence now of this actual, as I said, an actual disciplinary subfield in Mormon studies, which may yet have a very good future.
And in that aspect, the frustration that you expressed earlier with the discussion being around peripheral issues and not central. Is that going to...
Will that be addressed by this?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think so. Excuse me. It's hard to say. I think there is some concern in Mormon circles because once a study becomes academicized, so to speak, then obviously the religious leaders of that tradition no longer have quite the influence that they did in the past in shaping that narrative. And so it remains a kind of open question as to what the value of the church would be, so to speak, in turning the... and turning their tradition over to the secular academy to be studied, to be investigated, to be taught. I think that certainly there is much good that can come from that. I think that the church itself has manifested in recent years its recognition that history needs to be an important ally and an important tool for better understanding their own faith. Witness the Joseph Smith Papers Project, for example, where the church is bringing out of obscurity and out of darkness all of these original sources and documents. And I think facing and representing the important fact that Mormonism as a tradition doesn't arrive ex nihilo, that there's a process of development, that the scriptures themselves have been redacted and edited and developed by Joseph Smith and others. So rather than seeing history and the historical discipline as a danger or a threat to Mormonism, I think the church has come to recognize that no, it needs to be an ally, and that these developments in Mormon studies can be very healthy for everybody inside and outside the church.
Have you personally ever anything that you've written, published, or discussed in some way run afoul?
Run afoul of the church? Church or its leadership? I don't know, because I haven't...
You haven't heard anything.
I haven't heard anything, and I haven't consulted with them. I think in general, as I said, that they have the line separating what Mormon scholars in the secular academy are doing and what the better Mormon scholars within the church are doing has almost disappeared. The kind of work being done on the Joseph Smith Papers Project is absolutely first-rate scholarship that would pass muster with any academic committee in the world. So I see myself as engaged in a project that is neither critical of the church nor apologetic per se, but that simply tries to better understand and illuminate the core of Mormon thinking and of the Mormon cultural tradition.
And, of course, the person whose lecture series has been named for, Leonard Arrington, a pretty good model in that respect.
Absolutely. He, in many ways, could be considered the father of Mormon studies. I never had the pleasure or the honor of actually meeting Leonard Arrington, but I, like anybody else in the field, is certainly a beneficiary of his work and contributions.
Terrell Givens, our guest for the entire hour on Access Utah. His presentation coming up tonight at 7 p.m. in the Logan LDS Tabernacle. His most recent book is going to be the focus of our discussion as we come back after the break. Stay tuned.
The Memoir Series, a selection of memoirs by summer citizens and students participating in the 4-Minute Memoirs course at Utah State University.
My cousin Pat. In May of 2005, my sister and I were in our office when our cousin Peggy called from Chicago crying. She said my 55-year-old cousin had died. She told us it was an accident and that he was being kept on life support so that his organs could be harvested. We went online to the Valparaiso, Indiana News. Sure enough, front page read, Volunteer Fire Department Chaplain Killed. The area was mourning this wonderful person. The article said that Patrick Gallagher had retired from the Chicago Fire Department and was a semi-retired attorney that had moved to Valparaiso 3 years prior. We looked at each other and laughed. We felt guilty about laughing, but we couldn't help it and laughed some more. Our comments to each other were, only Pat could get away with these kinds of headlines. Years ago, Pat told his mother he had cancer of the mouth. His mother called the hospital Pat said he was going to, and sure enough, there was no record of Pat, Patrick, or P.J. Gallagher. My aunt, Pat's mom, chalked it up to Pat's tendency to exaggerate. He had done this since he had learned to talk, and nothing would ever change. Another time, Cousin Pat went to his sister's to get sympathy regarding a recent romance. His sister wasn't sympathetic, so he decided to leave. But just as he reached the front door, he grabbed his chest and went down. His two nephews rushed to get their mom to help him. Peggy assured her sons that Uncle Pat would be all right and that they should go upstairs, get their pillows, bring them downstairs, and lay right next to Uncle Pat and watch him. The boys did as their mom suggested, and pretty soon Pat was fine and said goodbye. Now back to the accident in May of 2005. Aunt Mary received a phone call from Pat's adult son. He said, "Grandma, you need to come to Valparaiso right now. Dad has been in a bad accident and is dying." The son did not have many details. Aunt Mary hung up the phone and thought, "Do I believe him? He exaggerates like his father, or do I not?" She decided to go. Yes, it was true. Pat was on life support. A car had hit him. When Pat and his wife Susan moved to Valparaiso 3 years earlier, Pat volunteered for the volunteer fire department. Somehow, Pat convinced the fire department that he was a chaplain. As a chaplain, Pat made a new policy. He went to every volunteer fireman and had them write down what they would like said in the event, God forbid, they were killed in the line of duty. Pat wrote his eulogy, too. Aunt Mary went with Susan, Pat's wife, to the funeral home to make arrangements. The director asked Susan if she wanted the military services, too. Susan said yes. Aunt Mary said, "Susan, Pat was never in the military." Susan looked at Aunt Mary like she was senile, and the military service was added. At the funeral, my uncle told my sister what happened. When he and Aunt Mary would be visiting Pat and Susan, a car would sometimes speed down the street. Pat could get beside himself with anger at those kids racing down the street. He would sometimes run out and holler at them. The day of the accident, Pat and Susan were planting flowers close to the street. Susan went toward the house for something, and here comes a speeding car. Pat went out in the street with his shovel in hand, and the car hit him. The shovel cut off the top of Pat's head. Pat had a fireman's funeral. Fire engines and fire trucks came from all over northern Indiana. Firemen stood at either end of Pat's coffin. His coffin was carried on the hook and ladder truck. The eulogy was fit for a king. As the eulogy was being read about him being an attorney in the military and a member of the Chicago Fire Department, my cousin Peggy leaned over to my sister and said, "If he wasn't dead, I would kill him." 3 weeks after the funeral, Aunt Mary was visiting Susan. Susan was writing thank you notes and appreciated her company. Susan asked Aunt Mary if she thought there was any life insurance through the lawyers' organization. Aunt Mary then looked straight at Susan and told her, "Pat was very smart, but barely graduated high school. He was never in the military, never went to college, and was never on the Chicago Fire Department. And to her knowledge, he was never a chaplain." She told Susan that he was a stagehand, period. Susan had been married to Pat for 10 years. Once she listened to my Aunt Mary, she pondered for a long moment, looked off into the distance, and began nodding her head up and down, up and down. Then she slowly said, "Yes. Yes. That explains a lot." Barbara Wiley Pecora.
This has been a memoir from the Memoir Series, a selection of memoirs by summer citizens and students participating in the 4-Minute Memoirs course at Utah State University. To hear more of these memoirs, check out upr.org.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams. Tom will be back next week. We are pleased to have with us in studio Dr. Terrell Givens, a professor at the University of Richmond and the author of many books and the presenter tonight for the 18th Annual Leonard J. Arrington Mormon History Lecture. Title tonight, The Prophecy of Enoch as Restoration Blueprint, and we've talked about that bit in the past part of our program. The author, as we have mentioned, of many books, got his start with Oxford University Press and published earlier this year I believe, when souls had wings. And this is a discussion of pre-existence, not only in, I assume, the Mormon tradition, but in literature and in many other aspects of society and history.
Exactly. As it turns out, Mormonism features
only to a slight degree in this book, just a very few pages. It turns out that pre-existence is an idea that has been virtually universal throughout time and place. The oldest religious tradition known in the West is the Babylonian. Mesopotamian texts already are talking about pre-existence, the fact that man had some kind of a spiritual existence or ancestry in the heavens. It was a part of the classical world. Plato, in many of his texts, discusses his belief that man existed as a spirit being among the gods before he came to this world. It is incorporated into the Hebrew tradition. Many, many of the early Christians believed in the preexistence of the soul. It was a pretty commonly held belief until the 6th century, when for a variety of interesting but rather complicated historical reasons, the Christian church declared belief in the preexistence anathema. Even so, the idea persisted through the Middle Ages. It springs up again in the 17th century among a group of what are called Cambridge Platonists. Almost anybody who's writing poetry in the 18th or 19th century in the Romantic or Victorian period espouses some form of preexistence. And poets as famous and recent as Robert Frost wrote major poems describing their vision of a world of spirit hosts preparing to come to Earth to be embodied. So it turns out that Mormonism, as I said, is just one of many, many traditions, although no Orthodox Christian church today teaches this doctrine.
The philosophy of Plato?
Absolutely. Plato is probably the most famous exponent of this idea and probably the most influential on subsequent thinkers. Again, one interesting dimension to Joseph Smith's treatment of preexistence is that he virtually alone among Western thinkers falls completely outside the Platonic tradition. His notions and descriptions of preexistence have much more in common with ancient kind of Ugaritic traditions, early Hebrew traditions involving things like the Council of Gods and other paraphernalia that is rather distinct and separate from Platonic varieties of this idea.
What was the Platonic variety?
Well, the Platonic variety is simply this, that we existed as spirits and that through some form of sin or error we fall.
We lose our wings?
Exactly, and that's where the title comes from. At least three different texts. One is from a Chaldaic tradition, one is a Greek tradition, and one a more minor tradition. All have the same image of angels, spirit angels who had wings, and then through their mistakes, their errors, their sins, they lose their wings and fall to earth. So for Joseph Smith, of course, embodiment is an ascent, whereas in previous traditions, Platonic traditions, it was a fall.
And in what century did you say that this...
6th century. It's the Emperor Justinian that declares an anathema on anybody who teaches the doctrine of preexistence. And the main reason for that is that if the soul is eternal, if the soul coexisted with God, then God can't be the source of everything that is, which is how the creeds state the nature of God. For example, the Westminster Confession. God is the source of all existence. So creation ex nihilo, the belief that God creates out of nothing, everything that is, comes into conflict with the eternal existence of the soul, and one of them had to go. So it was the pre-existence that lost out.
But it didn't lose out entirely.
But not
entirely. And why is that? Well, what is the part of this idea that is so
appealing? I'm really glad you asked that question, because that's really how I wrote the book, was an attempt to answer that question. If it was anathema, why did it persevere? What is there about the idea that was so compelling that it continues to resurface even at the present moment? And I found 6 or 8 reasons or explanations, and I can share some.
Please.
Of those. Well, if you're a Hindu, for example, or if you read the great Asian epic, the Ramayana, you will find that every time something disastrous happens to the hero, he has a ready explanation. He says, oh, I know why that happened to me. I must have been really lousy in my previous life. So preexistence was thought by many to give the best explanation that makes sense out of the justice of God. Why are some born rich and why are some born poor? Why are some born healthy and some are born lame? Well, one explanation is those who are really righteous deserve the better life. Or Plato gave the opposite explanation. Plato suggests in his Republic that those who have a really lousy life here are the ones who wanted trial and opposition in order to acquire virtue through their struggles. But in either case, it provides a scenario that helps us make sense out of present circumstance. Then there are many people who believe in love at first sight or in friendship at first sight, and they believe that the preexistence gives the best explanation of why they feel this immediate connection with somebody that is hard to explain otherwise. Third example would be that the preexistence could explain the phenomenal manifestation of talent at an early age among people. William Blake, for example, wrote...
We were born with it.
Exactly, yeah. And William Blake says, no, I couldn't possibly have acquired these gifts and skills in the mere 20 or 30 years I've been alive. I must have exercised them in the premortal life, he said in a letter to a friend. So that's a third reason. A fourth explanation would be, how is it that we're born seeming to know so many things? We know... We have this intuitive moral sense. We have all these values that just seem to be part of our innermost being. And again, another explanation would be, well, we acquired those values, we learned them in a prior existence, and bring them with us here. And then lastly, you have simply the intimations that people like Wordsworth write about in their poetry. So many people just sense that they've always lived. They can't accept the fact that their very self-existence, their identity, their consciousness is something that was created at a recent moment in time. And an eternal preexistence gives more meaning to those vague intimations of immortality.
In researching and writing the book, did it surprise you, the extent
I was astonished. Now, I teach English Romanticism and British and European Romanticism. So I became acquainted fairly early in my professional career with a slew of 19th century thinkers. Everybody in the Mormon Church is familiar with Wordsworth's Intimations Ode, right? Trailing clouds of glory, do we come from God, who is our home? But the more I read and taught 19th century literature, the more I became aware that it was pervasive in that century. Then I wondered, well, I wonder if it was in the 18th century. And the further back I went, the more I found. And I could have easily written two volumes on this subject, but the one volume tires enough readers as it is.
Tara Gibbons, with us for about another 15 minutes again. We invite your questions at 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email. Oh, looks like we have one. We'll check that at upraccess@gmail.com. And on this question, my perspective is that someone who is not LDS, but has lived in Utah for 32 years. And I identify this, I guess, because of my proximity to the religion as primarily a Mormon thing.
Well, as I said, I was determined to try to find if anybody in the Christian world today was teaching the idea of the preexistence of the human soul. And there is certainly no mainline Protestant tradition, and it's still anathema in the Catholic tradition. So there may be small little groups here and there, but generally speaking, it is absolutely unique to Mormons within the Christian world.
We have a call coming in, but I'd like to ask you about the book that's coming out in a week. And as a scholar and member of the faculty and someone who has published, I think we could say primarily to a scholarly audience, this book takes you in kind of a new path?
Yes, it does. And I had great reservations about writing this book and stepping outside of the kind of academic niche. But I think, like most academics, I would like to think that some of what I have to say would be interesting to a wider readership than the typical few who buy books published by an academic press like Oxford. And so I was asked if I would write this book on Mormonism for a national audience. And so I agreed to do so and ended up collaborating actually with my wife, Fiona. And so we call the book The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. And it's our attempt not to evangelize or be apologists or be critics, but to simply present what we think is the essential story that Mormonism tells about the human soul. And to our minds, Mormonism is a wonderfully coherent and compelling version of a narrative. It's a compelling narrative that tells us about a God who weeps when we weep, who feels what we feel, who is a God of body parts and passions. Mormonism tells of a human soul that has an eternal past rooted in that eternal world with God. Mormonism has an uncannily positive, optimistic view of human nature and human potential. It seems to me that it doesn't even make sense for Mormons to refer to the fall, because Mormons believe that mortality is an ascent, not a fall. It's not a catastrophe. It's part of a magnificent plan of mortal education and empowerment. Fourth, we think that Mormonism in many cases seems to have lost its heritage that can be traceable back to Joseph Smith, that Mormonism is a universalist tradition. Joseph was emphatic, and his revelations are emphatic in declaring that God has the power, the capacity, and the desire to save the entire human family. We think it's sadly ironic that Mormons sometimes have a reputation for being exclusivist or secretive, when in fact they have certainly one of, if not the most, universally embracing traditions in the Christian world, where virtually every single man, woman, and child will be saved. And then finally, Mormonism defines salvation as the extenuation of those relationships that we most cherish at the present moment. And those seem to us five fundamentals of the Mormon faith that are too often excluded from general conversation and from media interest.
The God Who Weeps, published by Ensign Peak Press, and that also suggests a somewhat different direction, a conscious choice.
Yes, yes, it was. It's not an academic press, but we felt that, as I said, these ideas were too important to confine to a small circle of academic publishers and their audience.
Is there any sense that this might create some ripples within the academic community, which you spend most of your time?
Possibly, and I would hope so, because I think that it's important. Increasingly, what we see in religious studies is the recognition that if members of the faith tradition don't realize the faith being described, then somebody has failed in their account. And I liken it in many ways to stained glass. I was in Notre Dame Cathedral this summer, and I'm always struck by how pedestrian and bland and grungy stained glass looks from the outside. And then you stand in the nave and the light comes through and the church is illuminated by this glorious panoply of color. And I think that faith traditions are much like stained glass windows. Whether you're a Mormon or a member of any other faith tradition, it's only from inside that tradition that you see the full ramifications and implications of what it means to embrace a particular set of beliefs and tenets. And so we believe that even writing as insiders, rather than from the outsider perspective of most academic books, that we make a valuable contribution to the understanding of Mormonism from the inside.
Terrell Givens is a professor of literature and religion at the University of Richmond. He's our guest, and we have a call from Washington County. Betty joins us. Betty, thanks for the call. You have a question.
I'm trying to balance what you've said about, and I am not Mormon, what you've said about pre-existence with the Eastern traditions of having lived another life before rather than just being a spiritual life before. Is not the feeling that you've known someone before, that the feeling that you've been there before, rather than the French déjà vu, not maybe that you have actually lived a life before?
It's a good question.
Excellent question. In fact, one of the most common questions I get is, how is pre-existence related to Eastern traditions of reincarnation? And the answer is that there are some strong affinities, but there are also some stark differences. Plato himself was of two minds. In some of his works, he espouses a belief in reincarnation and cyclical rebirth. In others, his version is more linear. There's a pre-existence, a mortality, and a post-life. And it is absolutely the case, as you indicate, that reincarnation can answer and address some of those very same questions and perturbing thoughts that give rise to pre-existence, which is why reincarnation has also been such a successful paradigm in religious thought in the East. In the West, generally, resistance to reincarnation can be traceable to one verse in the New Testament in particular, which indicates it is given unto man once to die. And so that one formulation seems to preclude for most Christians the belief that we could engage in multiple lives. And so Mormonism is quite clear in differentiating its belief in preexistence from reincarnation as such.
Of course, as far as I know about reincarnation, you don't really die.
Well,
the modern word would be morph.
Right, into, right, or transmigration is the word. So actually, yeah, it's multiple incarnations.
Right, yeah. I thank you very much for that. It's very interesting to listen to you, and I hope to get your book.
Thank you. Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Betty. Thanks for joining us. Also going on today are a series of meetings and panels of a group not affiliated with Utah State University, but people who study and discuss questions about the Mormon faith. And that's happening today as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, there is the annual conference of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, also known by their acronym, the SMPT, which is a group of a vibrant and really interesting gathering of scholars, young and old, who are interested in exploring the dimensions of Mormon thought and belief in a rigorous way, so rigorous that they actually, as I said, denominate their organization the Study of Mormon Theology and Philosophy. Of course, it's long been denied that Mormonism has a theological tradition, which is ironic, of course, because when Joseph Smith founded the School of the Prophets, the first series of lectures which he gave there were originally called Lectures in Theology, not Lectures in Faith. So Joseph and Brigham Young both spoke well of theology at times. At other times, they were rather hostile. Hugh Nibley famously said, theology is what happens when you don't have revelation. And so Mormons have tended to be averse to use of the term. But this group of scholars gets together once a year, and they're doing their best to foment and develop a theological tradition.
And frequently what's on the agenda for these sort of gatherings suggests what's happening right now. So what are they going to be?
Well, many times,
about?
Although this time their topics are not so timely as much as their focus on one particular question, which has to do with the role of the Book of Mormon in Mormon thought and Mormon theology. As I indicated, I've written on the opinion that the Book of Mormon enacted certain principles, particularly those that have to do with an open heaven, an open canon, dialogic revelation, but that it doesn't itself actually found or explicate or elaborate much theology. And I think we're probably going to have a number of dissenting voices in this conference that's taking place here in Logan over the next few days.
They're not going to be talking about the Mormon moment?
I don't think so. I don't see any such topic on the agenda. They're going to have topics like God and man at Hill Cumorah, the promise of Book of Mormon theology, Prisca Theologia in the Book of Mormon, grace in the Book of Mormon, those kinds of topics.
Some time back, and I'm having a hard time remembering the exact context of our conversation, but you used the term apologist.
Right.
And that comes up frequently in the discussion of the role of religious studies programs or in challenging ones.
Yes, it does. It's a very fraught term. In fact, one of the panels Friday at this conference will be on, it's essentially really on the nature of apologetics, although they're calling it secular norms and the scholarship of faith. Here's the problem. If you're going to engage in a religious studies program, how do you do that without advocacy? If you're going to talk about the Catholic faith, how do you do it without either putting Catholicism in a good light or seeming to put it in a bad light? Now, scholars will claim that the study of religion is something that can be done objectively in ways that we study any other academic topic, but not everybody is convinced. And I think that's one of the reasons for which religious studies has been controversial at state institutions. The term apologist is, I think, it's a term much like the word cult. When Martin Marty, the great scholar of religion, was asked, how do you define a cult? He said, oh, that's easy. That means you belong to a church I don't like. And I think he's right. It's lost its usefulness as a term because it's too colored with negative connotations. And the same is true of apologist. When people are thought to be describing or discussing a religious movement or tradition in terms that make someone uncomfortable, they will often say, oh, he's just an apologist. What they really mean is he is speaking in celebratory or positive terms about a tradition I don't like. So I don't find that that's a term that has much usefulness today either.
But it will always be there in a source of tension when you are trying to provide an academic examination of...
Absolutely. There will always be, you know, that will kind of be the line that you're not supposed to cross. And I think,
and
well,
where is the line?
And yeah, exactly. That's going to be infinitely negotiated. And I agree that teaching religion should never be advocacy of religion. That's I give that. But at the same time, I would point out that nobody says, oh, you can't write a biography of Shakespeare. You're prejudiced. You like Shakespeare. Or you can't write a biography of Hitler. You're prejudiced. You think he was a bad man. We recognize that in all academic endeavors, we are defending a particular position or proposition. And yet nobody calls Shakespeare scholars apologists. And so I'm just saying that I think the playing field needs to be level.
Dr. Terrell Givens, professor of literature and religion at the University of Richmond, the author of many books, most recently the one we talked about earlier, When Souls Had Wings, has been with us for the hour. He is in Logan to present the 18th annual Leonard J. Arrington Mormon History Lecture. And our thanks to the sponsors, Special Collections and Archives at the Merrill Kazare Library, the Leonard J. Arrington Lecture and Archives Foundation, College of Humanities and Social Sciences, and fundamentally Utah State University. Presentation tonight at 7 in the Logan LDS Tabernacle is free and open to the public. Title of Terrell Givens' presentation, The Prophecy of Enoch as Restoration Blueprint. And it's... been a delight to have you with us. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on our Thursday edition of Access Utah. Tom Williams returns next week. Filling in, I'm Lee Austin. Thanks for joining us. Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.